Terrific.
Excuse me, can I have everyone's attention, please? We're going to kick off in just a few minutes. Do turn off your cell phones if you haven't already. And a quick reminder that on Thursday, Robert Suter from Georgetown University School of Foreign Affairs is going to be talking about China's rise in Asian and world affairs. Then we'll go quiet for a week and a couple more events later in the month before the summer doldrums kick in. Today's speaker, I'm very sorry to do this to Stephen because it happens all the time, but as many of you will know from, if you've seen me host here before, I can often be a bit slow on the uptake. And being from New England, when I first saw the email that Stephen King was going to be speaking here, I thought, well, it was my fellow New Englander Stephen King, the horror writer. And I thought that was a bit of a stretch for the FCC because, generally we have serious people talking about serious subjects. And then I looked at the title of the talk, Losing Control, the Emerging Threats to Western Prosperity, which also seemed to be rather scary if you've noticed the cover. And but I still thought, well, that's a bit of a stretch for Stephen King, the horror writer. Fortunately, as I made my way down the announcement, I figured out that this Stephen King is HSBC's group chief economist and eminently qualified to speak on the subject at hand. I'm sorry to mention that he is a columnist for The Independent. However, more promisingly, he is also a member of the Financial Times Economist Forum, and we understand that the Independent gig is just a warm-up for Martin Wolf's slot at the FT. You will notice that Martin Wolf, my colleague, has greatly endorsed Stephen's book. So without further ado, Stephen, thanks very much for coming to the FCC today.
Well, thank you very much, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My book is not entirely a horror story, but there are some linkages with the other Stephen King, because although for this part of the world, the story, I think, is extremely positive, for other parts of the world, specifically what you might describe as the Western world, the US and Europe and so on, life will be, I think, extremely difficult over the course of the years to come. And this is an issue which I think has been, in one sense, poorly understood by writers in general over the last few years. I'm thinking here of factual writers rather than fictional writers, but I'm thinking here specifically of views on globalization. And there seem to be two variants of the globalization story, both of which effectively assume that globalization is a kind of a Western story, it's a Western-led story, it's a Western agenda, which then simply feeds through to other parts of the world for good or bad. One alternative version of this story is to say that globalization is simply a reflection of the spread of Western liberal democracy values and free market values into other parts of the world. So if it's the case that the West has been rich because of those values, then if you can spread them to other countries, then everyone can be rich and life becomes extremely easy. That's a very positive take on globalization, but it's again a Western-led story. The slightly more negative view of the story, I suppose, is the idea that globalization is all about the exploitation of cheap resources, whether commodities or labor in other parts of the world, by evil Western multinationals, a kind of variant of the imperial conquest view of the world. But again, it's a Western-led agenda. So when you look at the variety of books on globalization, both pro and anti-globalization, they tend to take one of those two strands. And it struck me that both of these approaches were wrong. And they were wrong because they assumed that actually the West itself would be still in control of the agenda over the years ahead. And it seemed to me that the way in which economies are changing at the moment, that assumption really wasn't safe. That the really key story about globalization isn't really the continued strength and influence of the West. it's actually the rise of everybody else and their influence in turn back on the Western world. So for me, the question is not so much for the West, how does it spread the message, but rather how does the West itself cope with the gravitational pull that is increasingly being exercised by China, by India, and by other fast-growing parts of the emerging world. Well, these are extraordinary changes that are coming through on a really epic scale. I'm fond of making the point that as far as China is concerned, its performance over the last 30 years in terms of economic growth isn't just unusual by the standards of the last 50 or 100 years, it's unusual by the standards of Chinese history over the last 500 years. It's even unusual by the standards of virtually every other country in the world in their economic history. So we're seeing some really extraordinary shifts taking place, which I think the West has really not quite coped with at this stage. Let me make a few comments about how life is going to change in the years ahead. These are perhaps assumptions more than anything else, but I think they are reasonably safe assumptions at this stage. The first one, as you all know, is that there's a very strong likelihood that China will be at the biggest economy in the world in 20 or 30 years' time. It may be that the compound growth rates in the future are not quite as strong as they have been over the last 30 years, but if China continues to catch up with the West, then it's likely that it will be the biggest economy. It won't be the richest economy because its per capita incomes will still be a lot lower than is the case in the States or in Europe. It probably will be the biggest economy in 20 or 30 years' time. Secondly, there's a numbers game involved here. It's a little demographic numbers game. If you think about the size of China, the size of India, put them together, they already account for about one-third of the world's population. That's a pretty meaty share of the total, but it also implies that as their per capita incomes begin to rise, they will have a huge impact on demand for what are effectively limited resources in different parts of the world. So one example of this already is that during this latest economic crisis, which for the West has been an absolutely terrible experience, oil prices have fallen back a little bit, but they actually haven't fallen back very far given the nature of the Western economic downswing. Let me try to explain a slightly different way. If you go back to, say, 2004 and 2005, when global oil prices were about $20 a barrel, and I said to you back then, what are the chances of seeing oil prices going up or down in the light of the deepest Western recession since the 1930s? My guess is the majority of us would have concluded that oil prices would have fallen from $20 a barrel maybe to $10 or $5 a barrel. The fact that up at $70 a barrel tells you quite a lot about the changing sources of demand around the world and the way in which the West finds it much more difficult to export its economic problems to other parts of the world. Back in the 1980s, when the U.S. had a deep recession, it effectively exported its recession to Latin America through the collapse in commodity prices that led to the Latin American debt crisis. This time around, much more difficult for the West to exert its influence on the prices of commodities all around the world. Another part of the numbers game is this, and this matters, I think, from the point of view of political influence in the years ahead. The developed world's share of the world's population of working age was 34% in 1950. That was pretty high by the standards of what's followed subsequently. But by 2050, the developed world's share of the population of working age will be down to just 12%. So the idea that the Americans and the Europeans can effectively tell everyone else what to do over the next 30 or 40 years seems to be increasingly unlikely. And you would already argue, I think, that there have been changes in international institutions as an attempt to reflect these kinds of shifts. The G20 may be a fairly weak association of countries, but it is, I think, a reflection of the way in which the world is changing as a result of the increased success of the emerging nations. Now, what does this all mean? I think there are two broad predictions I would make, which are already beginning to come through, which are actually a real challenge to Western societies and Western values. The first of these is that if it really is true that the emerging nations continue to grow quickly, they're at a stage of development currently which is very focused on the consumption of raw materials and commodities of one sort or another. to use a sort of technical jargon, the income elasticity of demand for raw materials from China, from India, and elsewhere is incredibly high given their per capita incomes. So the chances are that over the next 10, 20, 30 years, commodity prices will rise rather than fall. That might not seem like a particularly strong observation, but throughout much of the 20th century, it's completely the opposite. In fact, the West's success over the last 200 or 300 years has been based, in one sense, on getting cheaper and cheaper access to raw materials in other parts of the world. You know, a few hundred years ago, it was mostly to do with colonization, but the key point here is that the West's success was fueled by cheaper and cheaper commodities. It's not so obvious that will continue over the years ahead. And the other big change is this, and this is a fundamental feature of this latest wave of globalization. If you think about how globalization has changed over the last 20 or 30 years, the thing that I would highlight more than anything else is the ability of capital to flow across borders. This is a fundamental shift. We had the last sort of high point of globalization before the First World War back in the 1900s, when cross-border capital flows reached a peak. That peak was surpassed in 1980, and since then the numbers have risen almost exponentially. It's been an extraordinary development. But what it means is that, if you like, the Western workers' monopoly access to global capital, which was a feature of much of the 20th century, is now under attack, it's under strain. The consequence of this is that the typical Western worker is finding they're much more exposed to global competition through outsourcing and offshoring than might have been the case in the past. And one of the implications of that is that within the West, it's not clear that everyone actually wins from globalization. There are winners, but there are also losers as well. And what this reveals, I think, is in one sense, two paradoxes about globalization, which are not necessarily properly understood. The first one is a paradox about income and wealth inequality. If you look at the numbers for income and wealth inequality across nations, what you find is that the gap between rich and poor nations is gradually narrowing. Not admittedly the very poorest nations, which are still very, very poor, but the way in which China and India have seen growth coming through so rapidly over recent years suggests something very, very good about globalization because it's narrowing the gap between the rich and the poor nations. But at the same time, simultaneously, we're seeing the gap between rich and poor within nations actually becoming quite a lot bigger. This is particularly true not just of China, which is going through the standard economic catch-up process, which is always associated with rising income inequality, but it's also true of the US, it's true of the UK, and other major developed countries. And as a sort of throwaway line here, I'd point out that the way in which this has been masked in the West until very recently is that although income inequality grew through this change in competitive environments, consumption inequality didn't. The people who didn't see income gains coming through were still able to consume very easily for one very simple reason, which is that consumer credit was freely available. And that's dried up over the last 3 or 4 years. So it raises the question of how people cope in this new world where income is under pressure, but where there's no longer the ability to raise consumer credit that might have been the case a few years back. And the other paradox is that globalization has moved in two different directions over the last 100 years. I've already referred to the way in which capital markets have changed, the way in which capital flows across borders much more easily. That is the highlight, the big driver of globalization over the last 30 or 40 years. But in the political sense, we actually have less globalization than we once had. And here I can make a comparison with where we were before the First World War. Before the First World War, there were only about 50 nation states in existence. There are now 200. There are 50 nation states because, of course, most of the nations that we take for granted today were part of empires. Now, I'm not going to argue that empire is a good thing. I wouldn't like to do that. But what I would like to argue is that actually empires make it relatively easy to regulate international capital markets. But if you have a situation where you've got lots of countries and a global capital market, how do you try and tie those two very diverse themes together? And we've seen over the weekend with the disagreements in the G20 about banking taxes and so on, that actually it's very difficult to do this. So that raises a big question, which is either do we see a move away from national sovereign states, which is the experiment that's going on within the Eurozone currently, or instead do we see eventually the global capital market beginning to implode and move in exactly the opposite direction that we've seen over the last 20 or 30 years? I think there's a kind of tension that's there which is not particularly easy to resolve. So my conclusion from all this is that we've dealt with income inequality through increases in debt. That's not so easy to repeat in the future. And we've dealt with the issue of capital flows by trying to come up with broad agreements, like, for example, within the Eurozone. But that also hasn't proved to be, as we've seen over the course of the last few months, particularly successful. The strain between the interests of national sovereign states within the euro area and the collective interests of the single currency itself have not really been sorted out properly. The combination of all these long-term themes gives rise to a number of challenges to the standard Western way of thinking about economic progress. And there are some short-term implications and some long-term implications. As far as the short-term implications are concerned, the first one is this. We think we understand things about trade. We think we understand that strong exports are a good thing, weak exports are a bad thing, and that countries that can pursue a strong export strategy will tend to do quite well. That's a fairly standard kind of argument, but actually over the last 20 years, it hasn't worked. I've heard recently that David Cameron, the new Prime Minister of Britain, has been saying Britain needs to export more to China. This is the big story for the future. If we can export more to China, we ourselves will be successful. If you look at the G7 nations and try and work out which of them has been the most successful at exporting to China over the last 20 years, the answer is Japan, which is kind of funny because Japan's domestic success has hardly been particularly visible over this last two-decade period. And what's actually going on in Japan's case is that the reason why Japan's exporting a lot of exports to China is it's exporting capital goods to China. And what that really means is that Japan is shutting down its domestic suppliers and creating suppliers coming through from China for the very simple reason that China offers much lower wages than is the case in Japan. Now, this is good news for Japanese multinationals who can cut their costs relatively easily, but from the point of view of the Japanese economy, it undermines the productive potential of the economy over a long period of time. This hollowing out process, as the Japanese call it, is something which I think has eaten away at the underlying performance of Japan over the last 20 years. So strong export performance, but not obvious that you end up with a strong economic performance associated with it. So one of the key metrics of success doesn't appear to have worked, at least for Japan, over the last 20 years or so. A second short-term implication is this. We think we understand how capital markets work in the West, or at least we thought we did up until about 3 or 4 years ago. We've now discovered that capital markets don't work quite as effectively as we thought they did. And here's been a really big change, I think, in perceptions about how we judge the success or failure of capital markets. 5 or 10 years ago, most central bankers in the West said, it's really good news that bond yields are very low because this is a vote of confidence in our successful anti-inflation policies. We're very credible as a result of these low bond yields. What they didn't say, and what they should have said, is that bond yields are low because of the savings behavior of China and Saudi Arabia and Russia, which have a particular skewed interest in putting their savings into treasuries rather than anything else. Now, of course, the Americans say, well, the reason why China does this is because of a mercantilist export policy deliberately trying to undervalue the renminbi exchange rate. But the alternative way of looking at this is to say the reason why China buys lots of treasuries is because the US won't allow it to buy anything else. It can't buy US companies because it doesn't want to see US companies falling under Chinese control. But the consequence of this savings behavior is that we've ended up with a year-in, year-out distortion to the cost of capital in the Western world, which encouraged other investors in the West to buy some really stupid things, like mortgage-backed securities in the US, like Greek government debt or Spanish government debt, things which seem to offer a rather attractive yield relative to treasuries, but which, as it turned out, came with much greater risks than people assumed at the time. In other words, the distortion to the global cost of capital as a result of the savings behavior of the emerging nations has contributed in turn to some of the upheavals that we've seen in capital markets over the last few years. A third short-term implication is on inflation. Again, Western central bankers like to think that somehow they're in control of the inflationary process, that if inflation is low and stable, this is a sign of victory for those Western central bankers. Not at all. The key reason why inflation has been low and stable in recent years has been partly a windfall gain associated with one particular aspect of the integration of the emerging nations, namely cheap manufactured goods. But as time goes by, we'll find that there are sometimes windfall gains because of lower manufactured goods prices. We'll also find there are other occasions when there are windfall losses associated with higher oil prices or higher food prices or other commodity prices. The point is that increasingly inflation in the West is distorted by the influences of the emerging nations. And the consequence over the last 10 years was that inflation was low for these emerging market reasons, but it didn't stop Western central bankers from cutting interest rates too far, and therefore subsequently contributing to the housing bubbles and so on that followed thereafter. So the situation here is that actually, from a monetary perspective, there needs to be a complete re-examination of whether inflation targeting really works particularly well in the world whereby so many prices are being influenced by developments outside of the Western world. Longer-term implications. Governments will have to deal much more with income inequality than they have done up until recently. I think this is going to become a big pressure valve for the Western world in the years ahead. Because of this loss of access to consumer credit, because of the failure of the banking system to be kick-started over the course of the last year, 2 years, because of what's going to be huge austerity in the fiscal side of things over the years ahead, what this all effectively says is that the West has been living beyond its means for many, many years. It's now time for a kind of reality check. The problem with this reality check is it will also reveal the heightened level of income inequality, and I think will in turn trigger a whole series of new protectionist sentiments that will threaten the whole process of globalization as it's been the case over the last 20 or 30 years. A second long-term implication is the return of state capitalism. When I say the return of state capitalism, I stress the word return. Because the myth, in one sense, about the Western world is that our success was built on free market capitalism. But actually, if you go back far enough, you discover that this isn't entirely true. The British East India Company is probably one of the best examples of all time of state capitalism. After all, it was the reason why India eventually ended up being part of the British Empire. And of course, the British East India Company was also heavily involved in certain matters concerning opium in the middle of the 19th century. The point about this is that Britain, in its imperial success, was an active user of state capitalism. And I see no particular reason why China, Russia, and others might not go down the same path themselves in the future. That raises all sorts of questions about access to resources. It raises questions about whether the allocation of resources in the world be determined by the markets or instead by deals struck between governments. And that will become an increasingly big theme, I think, in the years ahead. And the third big question for the West is what to do with their aging populations. Because the truth of the matter is that as those populations age, the dependency of the West on the hard work of people in the emerging world will actually become greater and greater. If pension entitlements are to be met, that will depend increasingly on the West being able to extract benefits from the emerging world. And that either means you invest more in the emerging world, which many Western nations have been reluctant to do. For example, Germany typically invests not so much in the emerging world, but in mortgage-backed securities in the US and Greek government bonds and so on. Or alternatively, it means the West has to adopt a renewed and enlightened approach towards immigration, which actually is moving exactly the opposite direction at this point in time. So these are big political challenges out there in the years ahead. And one final comment on this story, and that is that in thinking about the US in particular, I'm aware, of course, that people's focus at the moment is very much on the Eurozone rather than the US, and the fact that it's the euro that's in trouble rather than the dollar, and the dollar, in one sense, has shown once again that it still enjoys reserve currency status. But there are some big difficulties out there, and in the book, I related these to a comparison between the sale of treasuries to international investors and the sale by the Catholic Church of indulgences to the hopeful people looking for a decent life in the hereafter. In both cases, the purchasers of the indulgences or the treasuries were indulging in an act of faith, a sense that somehow, somewhere, there'll be some benefit from buying these things. Now, of course, with the Catholic Church, the great thing was that you couldn't really prove whether you got value for money until after you were dead, in which case it was probably too late. But of course, the money that was raised was designed to build churches and cathedrals and indulge in a few crusades here and there. And in the US, of course, the timeline is not quite so never-ending. It isn't a story about the hereafter. But it's a very big question for the foreign creditors as to exactly whether it's likely that the US taxpayer could really end up being able to pay back those creditors in the future. And in fact, the problem I think the US ultimately has is that it's indulging in the same policies that the Spanish used back in the 16th century, because back in 16th century Spain, it had control of the world's reserve currency printing press, just as the US has control of it today. The world's reserve currency back then was silver, And Spain had control of silver because it discovered lots of it in Mexico and Bolivia as a result of the conquests at the beginning of the 16th century. The consequence of all the silver being shipped across to Spain was that the Spanish could live the good life. Well, not all of them could because the Inquisition was going on at the time, but some of them lived the good life. And basically gave this silver to other people in Europe who made nice things for the Spanish to enjoy. If it all sounds strikingly familiar, it should be, because, of course, the U.S. it once has done a very similar thing by exporting its dollars to other parts of the world and enjoyed the benefits of other people producing stuff for the Americans over the course of the last few years. The point about this is that eventually things went wrong for Spain, because eventually, as other people became stronger economically, as they furnished the desires of the Spanish, they also became stronger militarily and politically as well. In fact, by the end of the 16th century, the Spanish Empire was crumbling, and actually it was England and Holland and eventually the French who took over. So in a kind of modern-day equivalent of this, the big threat to the U.S. in the years ahead will be by abusing its reserve currency status. It has simply contributed to the rise and the might of China and other countries, which will indeed provide the same kind of threat as the English and the Dutch provided to the Spanish over the years ahead. So how does the West deal with all this? How does it cope with all these difficult issues? Well, I think there are some key options out there. The first one, which I've been rather criticized for subsequent to writing the book, is to actually take the Euro example as an example of an attempt to try to pull together national sovereignty. Now, things look terrible at the moment. You could imagine in a few years' time things might look a whole lot better if the Europeans can come up with a way of pooling their fiscal sovereignty as well as their monetary sovereignty that's already pooled together. It may be that the Euro might provide a template for other regional currency unions at some point in the future, which try and deal with this conflict between national sovereignty and global capital flows. A second option is the return of 19th century great power rivalries. We see a lot of that beginning to develop. So the friendly relationship that China and the U.S. have currently become a lot less friendly as they try to exert their own separate influence on third parties in other parts of the world. And the third possibility is protectionism, a new Cold War, and possibly worse. And I'll leave the worst to your own collective imaginations. So for the West, what are the choices? I think the choices are as follows, neither of which are particularly attractive. The first one is to say, look, the West has had its time on the economic sun. The world is changing significantly. It is time to grow old gracefully, to accept that the baton of economic growth has been passed to other parts of the world. That's actually the opportunity the West has had. It's got fairly rich. It can preserve its per capita incomes and do quite well, but it can't do much more than that. And have to accept that its bargaining position at the global level will diminish over time. The second option, instead, is to effectively dismiss globalization, to effectively go into reverse, to dismiss all the benefits of global capital flows, to become increasingly protectionist, disengage from the rest of the world, but in the process, ultimately doing undue harm to itself. Bear in mind that if the US were to continue abusing its reserve currency status, you'd eventually end up with a much higher cost of capital for the US, much more difficulty with dealing with its fiscal problems, much more difficult dealing with trade. And also, if the West were to disengage, I think the emerging markets would actually continue in a separate economic development that will continue regardless of what the West does. And there's the growth of what I describe as a new Silk Road, connections oversea, across land, by planes, and by the electronic ether, which are connecting new forms of trade, what you might describe as south-south trade between China, Brazil, India, sub-Saharan Africa. These are the new trading relationships that we built over the course of the years ahead. And as they are built, the dependence of Asia and other parts of the emerging world on the West will slowly diminish. And on that possibly cheerful note, I'll end my presentation. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
We have about 15 minutes for questions, so let's get straight into it. I'll ask the first one. When you do ask your question, please do identify yourself. And if you're seated somewhere where I can't see you, if you just get the staff's attention, they'll bring a microphone to you. Stephen, speaking of the assumptions underlying globalization, one of them was that there was a seemingly endless supply of cheap non-union labor in China, with all the consequent benefits for American consumers that you also touched upon. with Honda ending a strike by giving a 34% increase to its workers at one particular plant, Foxconn doubling wages. Is that assumption no longer valid? And what are the consequences of these for Western of these raises for Western consumers?
First of all, there are going to be some teething difficulties along the way. I wouldn't like to describe this as being a straight line assumption that takes place year by year. But the comparison I'd like to use is with the success of the US in the 19th century, where there was a continuous supply of immigrant labor, which actually fueled continued US growth. Of course, the original supply of immigrant labor was slavery, but subsequent to that, most of it was voluntary immigration coming through from parts of Europe. So, in effect, America's labor supply increased dramatically over the course of the 19th century. The equivalent, I would argue here, you may be wondering what the relevance of this is, particular answer, is that between Western and Eastern China, there is a similar migration story taking place. But you could treat, therefore, Western China as the equivalent of Europe in the 19th century, and you can treat Eastern China as the equivalent of the US in the 19th century, i.e. opportunities that are presented, which provide a steady supply of relatively cheap labor over an extended period of time. You'll get bottlenecks, of course, from time to time, which force those kinds of big increases coming through. But what this results in is effectively a transition of labor from rural activity into manufacturing activity, and that gives the clue as to why you can get away with relatively high wage increases, because for those workers, you end up with tremendous productivity gains, which mean that if you have wage increases averaging 10%, if productivity gains are also 10%, then unit labor costs, which will matter for competitiveness, are zero. And that, of course, is hugely competitive. Secondly, I point out that if you look at per capita incomes in China, well, on average, they are about $2,000 or $3,000 a year, which compares about $40,000 a year in the US. So even if there are pockets of, you know, exceptional wage increases coming through, the relativities are still very, very stark. Thirdly, and I think this is a longer-term theme, when you look at the quality of labor, obviously there's a big assumption in the West that the quality of labor is much greater in the West, and to be fair, the education systems in the West are generally better. But the number of graduates now coming out of Chinese and Indian universities, A, is very, very large, but B, is accelerating all the time. So again, the quality of labor is improving, and that in turn I think will also be associated with a continued competitive framework in the years ahead. So for me, the big challenge is not so much the increases in wages, but rather the fact that if China were to be vulnerable in this situation, it would be the fact that the low wages ultimately lead to protectionist pressures coming through from the US. And that, of course, comes back to the debate about the renminbi and about alternatives to a renminbi revaluation in terms of tariffs and quotas and so on.
Questions from the floor?
Thanks very much. Rachel Cartland. I'd like to question about one issue you picked up on, which was income inequality within the developed world. And I'd like to ask how you think that ought to be rectified, because, you know, obviously one of the traditional ways or obvious ways to do that is by transfer payments, simply from rich to poor. But at the moment, the sort of situation where the developed countries' governments are also trying to reduce their budget deficits and so on, that seems to be not very practical. So I wonder what you think about that.
This is a very, very tricky issue. I think it will become worse over the years ahead. First of all, just the facts. If you look at the US numbers, what is fairly clear is that even college graduates have not really seen particularly significant wage increases over the course of the last 20 or 30 years. They've had wage increases, but nothing like in line with the productivity gains that they've achieved. And that raises a big question about who've been the winners from globalization within the US. And the answer appears to be that it's a sort of top 1 or 2% of the population that have become like mega rich over that period of time. And the vast majority have not really engaged. So what you could loosely say is that the real winners from globalization have been workers in China and India who've seen their wages steadily rising, and the rich in America becoming super rich, and other people in the States, you know, not quite so sure as to how things have progressed. How you deal with this, well, in the short term, I think you're absolutely right, with great difficulty, because there's no doubt that the first priority of governments in the West will be to try to balance their budgets. And this raises a broad issue, which is that everyone in the West, more or less, has been living beyond their means over the course of the last 10 or 20 years. this was first shown up in the banking crisis, but subsequently, of course, has come through with these massive government deficits, which are a consequence of dealing with the banking and financial crisis over the last two or three years. And unfortunately, when it comes to dealing with these kinds of deficit difficulties, the evidence does strongly suggest that the first thing you have to do is raise taxes, not because you want to do that for the long term, but rather because you want to convince markets that you are entirely credible and committed to reducing your deficit. And the quickest way of doing that in the immediate future is going for either tax increases on incomes or indirect tax increases like, you know, value-added taxes and so on. So I think the process over the next year or two will be not just slow, but probably a reverse of what may ultimately need to happen. Moreover, of course, then you get to the point of thinking you're going to cut back on public spending, which again will affect a large majority of people. So this is going to be a very long, drawn-out process and not particularly easy. My fear, and this is one of the remarks I've already made, is that if it is the case that fiscal policy can't be used to deliver transfers in the immediate future, if it is the case that the gap between rich and poor remains relatively large and consumer credit can't paper over the cracks, then the risk of protectionism will undoubtedly rise. This kind of isolationist approach, of course, we last saw in the first half of the 20th century, triggered, of course, by the First World War, but in the 1920s, 1930s, the whole process of globalization, which everyone had taken for granted up until 1914, went completely into reverse, and it was only sort of recreated in the 1980s and beyond. So if it starts to go into reverse, it could be very damaging. So my worry is the combination of income inequality and protectionist pressures could ultimately be extremely damaging for everyone.
There's another question.
It's John Ogden. I just wondered, you know, economics has become some term the dismal science, particularly after, you know, 2008, 2009, where most economists missed all the fact that we're sitting on the edge of a precipice. I just wondered, you know, in your position as HSBC, if you're able to foresee that. And the second thing is, I wondered if you're travelling down a sort of familiar road. We had a lot of people putting out books in like 1989 saying Japan was going to take over the world, and obviously we know what happened since. You mentioned yourself that China has had the best run of growth of anybody over history. So you just wonder if they're actually setting themselves up for one of the biggest crashes in history. So I just wonder what your thoughts on that. Because, you know, economists do have a tendency just to draw a straight line, say, okay, here we go, 20 years, we're going to be the biggest economy in the world, and that could be a big mistake.
Yeah, you're right that economists are very fond of extrapolation, which makes you wonder what they're trying to talk about most of the time. First of all, I think a lot of economists have a problem, and I have this problem as well, not just being an economist, of course, but the fact that our knowledge of history is quite shaky. People rely on data and quantitative models, which are often based on a very short run of history. For China and for Asia more generally, the process we've been through, not just over the last 30 years, but for Asia in total for the last 50 or 60 years, has been absolutely extraordinary. We have reasonable data, not perfect data, but reasonable data going back over about 1,000 years of economic development. And if you really want to believe the numbers further back, you can go back about 2,000 years, and you can look at how per capita incomes have progressed. And the really big surprise over the last 2,000 years isn't China and isn't India, it isn't the Middle East or Africa, it's actually Europe and Europe's subsequent satellites, if you like, in the form of North America and Australia and New Zealand. It was those countries that broke the mold in the 16th, 17th centuries. And they're the ones who've done a peculiar thing relative to history. Everyone else has been, if you like, subject to the kind of Malthusian constraint, sort of living at subsistence levels all the time. And of course, the reason why the West did this was partly because of technological and productivity improvements, but partly also because of conquest and colonization and slavery and so on, which are all very important parts of the original Western success story over previous years. Now, what I'm really arguing is that the process of capital moving across borders has allowed the technologies that were, if you like, monopolized by the West over previous times to spread much more quickly into other parts of the world. And that process of economic catch-up, I think, is something which may be sustained for quite a long period of time. This comes back to this issue of per capita income comparisons. You're absolutely right about Japan, of course. I mean, there are lots of people writing about Japan doing very, very well. I would argue, though, that rather than Japan being a threat to the Chinese story, I think Japan's a threat to the Western story. In other words, that Japan's a precursor to what happens more broadly if you end up being an economy that's hooked on debt and asset price gains of one sort or another. And that's been broadly true of the States and Europe as well over the course of the last 10, 15 years. But the big difference between Japan in 1989 and China today is that Japan had effectively reached the global technology frontier in 1989. Its per capita incomes were very, very high. And therefore, what really mattered for Japan thereafter was the allocation of capital. If capital couldn't be allocated efficiently, then the growth numbers wouldn't look good. Alongside that, of course, Japan bumped into a demographic constraint. But if you take China, or indeed many of the emerging nations, the resource that's misallocated isn't so much capital, which is, of course, from time to time, it's labor. On a global basis, labor is hugely underutilized in China, India, and elsewhere because labor hasn't had the opportunity to get access to global capital. But now that it is getting access, it does point to continued rapid gains over a number of years. So let's imagine there's a bubble in China. Let's imagine it bursts and things go wrong. The question is, how wrong would they go? And I would argue that because much of the growth in China is what you might describe as supply-side technology-driven rather than demand-side bubble-driven, even if there were a hard landing, the hard landing might be essentially with growth for 1 year of 6% or 7%, but it would then rebound relatively quickly, which is not quite the same thing as talking about the kind of structural shift downwards in growth that Japan suffered from. The other thing I'd add, of course, is that for China specifically, of course, there is a demographic time bomb ticking away that will be a constraint on growth in the future, and everyone knows this. But for the emerging world in general, that time bomb really isn't ticking, at least not yet. So for India, for the Middle East, for sub-Saharan Africa, and parts of Latin America, their population demographics will continue to provide people of working age rapidly over the course of the next few years. So I think it's important to recognize that the book itself is not specifically about China. It's about a broader story of emerging market trends over the years ahead. And that, I think, is still a very powerful story.
We can take one last question. We do have to be conscious of time, as Stephen's got another appointment. But Ben, please.
Yeah, hello, Ben Richardson, Bloomberg. I just wanted you to finish the thought on resource competition. Just along the idea that there seems to be a narrative, an orthodox narrative at the moment, that China and India and the rest of the emerging markets are going to get richer and richer, and that people's standards of living are going to rise up to Western levels. And I just wanted you to finish the thought about the limited amount of resources and how you see that playing out.
Yeah, there's an example I use in the book, actually, which is what I call growth through technology replication rather than technology enhancement. What I mean by that is that a lot of the growth we're seeing in the world today is not so much because of improving technologies, it's because the same technology is being used by more and more people. And the example I use in the book is passenger air travel. If you look at the cost per passenger mile of air travel, it's fallen by about 75% over the last 50 years. So the efficiency with which passengers are being transported is much greater now than it was. And that's your example of technology improvement taking place, which is resource saving. There's no doubt about that. But the difficulty is that the number of passengers being transported has gone up sevenfold over the same period. So although you've got an improved efficiency per passenger mile, you're actually still using more resources than was the case previously. And it's that kind of story, I think, is being played out in a number of different industries, a number of different areas over the years ahead. I think the implication of this is that access to scarce resources will once again become quite important. Again, looking back to the 18th and 19th centuries, the way in which the West dealt with its problems of scarce resources was to go and find them somewhere else through a bit of colonization and so on. We're not going to see quite the same process taking place today, of course, but it's interesting when you look at the state deals being struck between China, for example, and countries in sub-Saharan Africa, there's clearly an interest in creating a state narrative over and above purely commercial interests. If you think about organizations such as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which of course is the relationship between China and Russia and some of the Central Asian republics, and associate membership with Iran and so on and so forth, these are new kind of political organizations designed to safeguard resources in a way which effectively excludes the West. I'm not saying it's done purposefully, but nevertheless, these are organizations which the West tends to ignore and forget about, but they are changing the patterns of global political relationships. So that's the kind of theme I would focus on.
Please join me in thanking Stephen for his very interesting talk here today.
Thank you.
As always, for our speakers, we try and find a gift that is appropriate. And while Stephen was talking, our general manager panicked and cleaned out our from the safe the club's supply of U.S. Treasuries, which we don't have much faith in anymore. So we'll pass those to you. Thank you very much, Stephen. Stephen is available for a few minutes to sign copies of his book, if anybody would like to do that. But please excuse him in advance if he gets whisked away in about 10 minutes' time, because he does have another appointment at 2:30. So if you do want that, maybe file up from my left. But he is happy to do that for a few minutes. Thank you.